KFI AM 640, it's Jane Wells filling in for John and Ken. We have been talking about the impact of this tax plan on Californians, and particularly those Californians at an income level that are really important to the state, the people who pay high income taxes, who have big mortgages and pay large property taxes and all that sort of thing. Those are the people who will be hurt by this new tax plan in high tax states like California, New York, New Jersey. Of course, one solution would be then to lower our taxes in Sacramento. But I got a bridge in Brooklyn I could sell you if you believe that. Joining me on the phone right now is Joel Kotkin, who is a fellow in urban studies at Chapman University in Orange. He writes, this is right in his wheelhouse. This is what Joel studies and what he writes about. Joel, thanks for joining us tonight.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Okay, we have seen, according to at least the State Association of Realtors, more people are leaving California than coming in here, than moving here. What difference do you think this tax plan makes?
Well, I think what it will do is it will probably, on the margins, bring some people out of the state. I mean, we've been having this out-migration. It was mounting, really, because of the very high housing prices. And really, outside of the Bay Area, not such a great economy either. So I think this will continue. What it may do is it may show a skewing of more well-to-do people leaving, because those are the ones, as you described, who are going to be hit very hard with the taxes, and they're going to say, well, you know, this is the last straw. I think this will take place over a long period of time. I think the bigger impact is going to be companies who are going to, when they think about expanding, for instance, saying, well, you know, maybe we should go to a state where the new tax laws help us, don't hurt us. And I also think it's going to be very, very difficult, and it's become increasingly difficult, frankly, for people in their 20s and 30s to move to California. You know, between taxes and high property prices, it's very, very difficult to get people to come in. And that's really, you know, probably a bigger problem than the people leaving.
Well, yeah, you know, even though Apple and Google and all these great companies, Disney in California, are going to see their corporate tax rate slashed, yeah, you're talking about expansion and investment being in other states, not here in their own backyard?
Well, yeah, I mean, we've already seen, like, for instance, Apple has 6,000 people in Austin, so that's about half the size of the people they have at the spaceship in Cupertino. You see companies like Google, like Facebook, beginning to expand in these places. And, of course, in terms of the overall tech industry, of course, the search by Amazon for a second headquarters, that's very much likely to go to a red state with relatively low taxes and relatively reasonable housing costs, because Seattle is on its way to becoming as expensive as California.
Well, also, I think in Amazon's case, they would love to have something closer to the East Coast for geographical reasons, whether it's near a port or I think Atlanta, maybe the winner there. But, you know, for a lot of Californians, their taxes will go down because they don't itemize. But you said something to me when we talked earlier about this sort of sectionalism concerns you, where one part of the country profits and another suffers.
Well, yeah, and frankly, it's not just something that Trump invented. It was something that actually was very prominent during President Obama's term. Many of the things that he was doing, particularly on the energy front, was like a shot right between the eyes for lots of economies in the Intermountain West and in the Midwest and in the South, and certainly in Texas. I mean, you know, I spend a great deal of time in Texas, and people who probably, you know, can't stand Trump on about 50 levels, but, you know, as one friend of mine said, well, yeah, but at least he doesn't hate on major industry. And you know, I think that you're going to see this kind of sectionalism accelerate. And one of the terrible problems is in the red states, you have fewer and fewer Democrats, and in the blue states, you have fewer and fewer Republicans. So there's not even any attempt to sort of realign things or try to come up with the kinds of compromises that American congressional process has always sort of prided itself on.
Yeah, do you think anyone in Sacramento, it might dawn on someone that, gee, this is going to hurt them, Californians that we count on. Maybe we ought to see about mitigating their tax burden to help offset this new federal plan. Am I crazy to think that?
Yes, basically, it's not going to happen because Sacramento now is a one-party, and not only a one-party city, but it's really now increasingly a one-faction of one-party city. In other words, the number of business Democrats has been has gone down, you know, step by step, because the problem that the Democrats have is that you have to swallow the entire dogma. You have, you know, you can't say, well, I'm against this, but I'm for that. You pretty much have to take the whole, you know, the whole thing.
The whole pile of you-know-what.
And right. And, of course, you know, one of the things I find really interesting is the media has not really helped here. I've just finished writing a piece that will come out on Sunday where Associated Press writes, a California booming economy, they're going to pass all these new wonderful things to give, you know, free health care to the undocumented and all these subsidies. And I'm sitting there saying, well, I'm reading the economic data, and the California economy is clearly slowing at a time when the rest of the country is doing better. And I do think that these tax changes are going to accelerate it. Now, whether in 2 years, 5 years, the people of California begin to say, hey, look, we don't want to pay these taxes, which are, by the way, in large part are to pay pensions for public employees, maybe they'll rise up. But, you know, increasingly what's happening, and this really ties to your original question, is the middle class family, and the upper, particularly the upper middle class family, that might be amenable to perhaps supporting somebody other than, you know, the current ruling party, they're leaving. And what's left are the very rich who can get around these tax issues and frankly just don't care, and in many cases have owned their homes, so they don't pay any property taxes anyway. And in some cases, they've already passed their era where they're going to worry about income taxes. And then a large group of public employees who've got a great deal here. And you have a large and growing population of poor people. We have to remember, one-third of the people, households in California, are basically at the poverty line or just slightly above it.
Well, and I mean, this is a story that played itself in a less extreme form after the dot-com bubble burst, where we started spending money like crazy, thinking the good times were going to last forever, and they did not.
Well, and I think we're going to see that. I mean, you know, if you take a look at what's happening in Silicon Valley, which has really been the driver of this economy, when you take a look at what's happening in Silicon Valley today, you know, there are layoffs, the people are not expanding. Because these giant companies like Apple and Facebook and Google are so dominant that startups aren't really happening. And so I think that you're really going to see some sort of contraction up there, and certainly not the continuation of the high growth. You have a large number of young people getting into their 30s, and you know they can't afford to live here as it is. This will make it worse. I know one company here, a architecture firm in Orange County, where they had to set up offices in Dallas and San Antonio for their people in their 30s. You know, when people get to that age where they want to get married, maybe have a family and buy a house, very difficult to do it. And when you take away the tax benefits, that's really going to have an effect of accelerating this flight. So I don't think this will change what was happening, but it could accelerate it.
Joel, can you please hold on because I really want to talk to you about this article that came out today, is The End Near for Religion, because the California birth rate is declining, and there's some interesting things in here about how many Californians are religious now versus what they were before, and general trends you see in the country and around the world. Can you hang on, please?
Sure. No
okay.
problem.
We'll get to that after the break, because I found it very fascinating, and given that it's the holidays, timely, something for us to think about. We'll get that when we come back. Jane Wells filling in for John and Ken, KFI AM 640, and here's Deborah with the news. KFI AM 640 is Jane Wells filling in for John and Ken. Listen to this. This is in the Orange County Register this morning. Even at this season that should be about spiritual reawakening, it is hard to deny that we live in an increasingly post-religious civilization. Virtually everywhere in the high-income world, faith, particularly tied close to institutionalized religion, has been dropping for a decade, and the trend is accelerating with each new generation. That was written by Joel Kotkin from Chapman University, who joins me on the phone right now and has been looking into this. Joel, what are you seeing in terms of religion in what you call the high-income world?
Well, I think what's happening is, and it's been happening first, of course, in Europe and in the Far East, but particularly in Europe, is that you just have a general decline in religious observance, a decline in people professing to be members of any faith, and it's very dramatic among millennials, and even among millennials, younger as opposed to older. So what we're seeing is radical reductions in the percentage of people who think their religion is important in their lives. And you know, you can see it if you go to a church or a synagogue today. Very often, particularly a mainstream Christian church.
I see it myself. We were Lutheran, and we left because it just, and we've gone to now a non-denominational church. Those are a bit more vibrant and growing. It depends. Younger churches are happening. Older institutionalized, yeah, they're not so happening.
And the same thing's true with the Reformed Jews. Reformed Jewish congregations are getting older and older. They're having a very hard time holding on to young people. And so what you end up with is you end up with the mainstream religions getting older and older, and their children are becoming less and less likely to affiliate. And so you see this almost everywhere. I mean, in large parts of Europe, the birthplace, really, of certainly Roman Catholicism and Reform religions, they basically don't exist. I mean, they have almost no relevance in the society, and the churches are more like museums than like places.
Yeah. I would say part of the problem in Europe is they made the church part of the state, and then everybody, taxpayers, were supporting it, and then they can't stand on their own. But I also wonder if it isn't because millennials are waiting later to have children, because people tend to fall away, and then they come back once they have kids.
Right, and of course what's happening is a fairly significant number are not having any children. And so, you know, that obviously has an impact. And also having one as opposed to three, that probably makes people a little bit less likely. I mean, it's not like it's game over. I mean, the long-term prognosis, interestingly enough, is probably good for religion because the secular people have so few children. So, you know, those people who, you know, live the single life in San Francisco and Manhattan, you know.
They're going to die out.
Right, they're going to die out. But in the next 10, 20, 30 years, I think religion will be greatly reduced. And I also think religions have done things to hurt themselves. Obviously, you have the scandals in the Catholic Church. You have, and this has been something I spoke about at my synagogue, probably to the discomfort of some of the clergy, where I just basically said, you know, if you turn, whether it's Reform Judaism or mainstream Protestantism, into sort of another form of progressivism, well, why go through your synagogue or church to be an activist and, you know, cut out the middleman and do it directly?
Well, didn't you say that's the biggest threat to religion? Maybe it's politicization, whether it's Roy Moore on one side, yeah, or the liberal activism on the other.
Right. I mean, when you know, let's say if you're in an evangelical church and you're in Alabama and your pastor saying to vote for someone like Roy Moore, you're starting to say, what? What does this have to do with Christianity? And so, you know, I think this is kind of the decadence of religion today, that since they can't really make the religion work on its own, they have to dress it up as political, whether it's right or left. And what's interesting is, you know, this movement towards being more religious has actually made them weaker. And, you know, also, like, I know even in my synagogue, you know, a lot of the people who maybe they're not really very conservative, but they don't buy the entire progressive agenda. Let's say they don't like sanctuary cities, or they don't think high taxes are going to make life better for everyone. Those people feel marginalized, and they may still belong, but they don't show up. They're alienated. They don't really get involved. And I think, I'm sure the same things are happening in mainstream Christian churches. So I think that this is a big problem. And then, as I write about in that article, there are these sort of new religions. You know, people who, you know, still have a desire for faith and belief in something, but they now believe in algorithms, or they now believe in Gaia, you know, in the green goddess.
Or as John talks about, they believe in, you know, climate change. That becomes their religion.
Right, exactly. Climate change, you know, it is something that defines everything. It's the answer to everything. I mean, look at you know, Jerry Brown. Jerry Brown, a sophisticated person, but you know, he's now basically a monomaniac. That's all he cares about. The poverty in California, people leaving California, the quality of life in California is irrelevant relative to climate change. It is so parallel to, you know, 5th, 6th, 7th century sort of Christian hysteria of that time, where the only thing that really mattered was man's relationship with God. Now it's man's relationship to the planet as I see it. That becomes the main thing. And so, you know, yeah, I mean, that, you have that. Obviously, you know, for some people, the social justice has replaced religion. And so you really have a decline in sort of faith as something that's organized. And I think also, frankly, you know, faith that sort of restricts what you can do.
But let me just say, Joel, I think the outlier here, particularly in Europe, is Islam. Islam is on the rise in Europe. I mean, that is a religion that is, while people aren't going to church or temple, they're going to the mosque.
Well, and this is also part of the problem, which is that, you know, Islam, of course, comes predominantly from poorer, you know, developing countries where people still are having children. And that's right. And what's happening in Europe is, you know, you could very easily see in 20, 30 years, maybe even sooner than that, there may be more practicing Muslims in France than practicing Catholics. I mean, this is not, you know, beyond the realm of possibility.
Well, then maybe the rebellious thing to do, then the pendulum will swing back to Christianity.
Well, I think one can hope. But
I'm not down on Islam. I'm just. It's an interesting. Whereas the church, and as you say, Reform Judaism have become more and more political. Islam, which is political in its own way too, is on the ascent, and they're having more kids. I think the one of the most interesting things is the end game is that believers of whatever faith. True believers tend to have more children, and those who don't believe will then be outnumbered.
Right. But the question is, what are the structures that will come during the 20, 30 years where this secularization is dominant? And that will be a very interesting.
I just got to ask you real quick. Does being a godless nation make you less or more productive? I mean, look at China. They're very productive. Of course, it's a totalitarian regime. But have you noticed whether godlessness has any impact on the economy?
Well, I think it does in the sense that it puts restraints. And, you know, I've spent quite a bit of time in China, and their religion, which is really sort of familialistic, you know, coming out of the Confucianist tradition, there are many, many signs around the bend among younger Chinese and where the work ethic isn't as great. People don't want to work in factories. They don't want to. They don't want to do the hard labor. Remember, the generation that rebuilt and made China such a great world power was a generation that grew up in poverty. I mean, I saw it myself 35 years ago. China was a very poor country. And it's those people, just like the Japanese who came out of World War II very poor, who drove that ascendancy. Whether it can survive without a system of belief, I think is questionable over time.
All right, Joel Kochan, thank you. Fascinating stuff. Take care.
You too. Thank you.